Blog Talk Radio.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Will a strong and united America still be a force for freedom and prosperity around the world?
America has created the longest peacetime economic expansion in our history.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Good common sense and sound judgment of the American people. And their essential love of justice.
Hi, welcome to the Kudzu Vine for December 8th, 2013. I'm your host, David McLaughlin. And joining me right now this week is one of our friends from the show who she's really just an expert all over the country because she works in so many different places, but she resides in Florida. So we like to call her our Florida and fundraising expert. Welcome back to the show, Miss Anastasia Apa.
David, so great to be with you guys again. Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, always a pleasure. Well, Catherine's going to be probably in a little bit later, and I tell you what, when we were doing our new format, when Tim had to leave the show, we talked about having rotating guest hosts, and she said, make sure we get Apa. And I said, I will. So she had requested you a while back, and I knew when it's come time for Florida, we were going to get you in. But before we get into Florida, Nelson Mandela passed away this week, and I just don't know that you can undersell the importance of his life and career. And I mean, he was almost the embodiment of a movement, not even just in his country, almost worldwide. Apa, you are a person of color, so he might even have touched your life even more than he did somebody that was Caucasian. How do you feel Nelson Mandela's impact was on the world?
Well, I have to say, you know, President Mandela, I mean, his passing is a loss for all of us. And, you know, anyone who can just lead the kind of life that he was. I mean, he was an anti-apartheid revolutionary. He was a politician. He was a philanthropist. And to go from spending 27 years in jail to help make others free and go from, you know, a jail cell to becoming president of South Africa, I think is just a true testament to his extraordinary life. And, you know, he will be missed by so many all across the world. You know, President Mandela was just, he's a legend.
Yes. I think probably the most important lesson anybody can learn from him is, as far as any human being, he embodies the word forgiveness. I mean, this is a guy, when he got power, you know, could have said, look, I'm going to repay everybody for all that was done to me. And he was so forgiving. You know, the movie Invictus, it's just about sports, which in the scheme of things is not as important as a lot of other things. But he had this, you know, white sport, white team, and he said, we're going to support them and try to bring the championship of rugby to America, and we're going to, you know, stand with them. And that really sent a symbol to the country that, you know, now that the majority of the people are black Africans are in charge, we're not just going to overrun the minority because we can. We're going to have a country of all. And so other countries like America, where you have the reverse, you know, black Americans are minority, you can say, look, this is somebody that had the majority and used it in the proper way. I mean, it was just a symbol for any country that has racial diversity of how you should conduct yourself, and I think that forgiveness is so important.
Certainly. You know, just a legend. I mean, that's kind of the making of a legend, someone who does things that have never been done before, you know, with gracefulness and with honor. And so when he had a chance, when he became president, frankly, he could have done probably lots of things to people who hadn't always been there, been supportive or been positive in his life, but he chose to take the higher ground, and those are the makings of a legend.
Yes, I read the book More Than a Game, and it's about the soccer league that was started in that prison on Robben Island, and it really doesn't have a lot to do with Nelson Mandela because he was in solitary confinement, but you find out how they treated some of those people. I mean, literally, one of the punishments was they would dig a hole and put a prisoner in the hole, leaving only their head up, and sit them in the sun where they would sunburn just incredible amounts and then dig them out. I mean, that was their kind of solitary confinement. I mean, so cruel and unusual. I'm sure like a group like Amnesty International and others would just, you know, be so disapproving, it's not a strong enough word for these kind of techniques. That's how the prison functioned. And Nelson Mandela was treated worse than the prisoners you read about in the book, so you just can only imagine, you know, how it was. And, of course, the solitary confinement for every day, year in and year out, 27 years, you'd almost think you'd almost lose your mind. I mean, you would begin to have mental illness just from this isolation, but in no way did this happen to him. I think you could go further. If you talk about, like, the 10 most important, you know, leaders of the 20th century, as far as just, you know, learning about what the century was. I mean, obviously you'd have people you don't like Hitler, and, of course, you know, maybe one or two of our presidents makes the list, like Franklin Roosevelt. But I could see Nelson Mandela making most people's list. Appa?
Yeah, well, that's for sure. And frankly, whoever's making the list, if they don't put him on the list, they ought to be locked up in prison for 27 years. The man is an icon. He's a legend. And I'm actually, Dave, I'm reading The Tao these days. I'm remembering this quote from The Tao that says, you know, the benefit of taking no action. And it really just describes having the ability to do something and choosing not to, you know, having the ability to crush your opponent and not doing so. And so spending 27 minutes with yourself thinking is something that everybody should do, frankly, and there's so much benefit from that. You know, he spent his 27 years in solitary confinement thinking and bettering himself and meditating and praying and planning. And frankly, you know, he made good use of his time. You know, President Mandela, you know, again, I just can't call him anything but an icon and a legend. He should make anybody's list in terms of influence. I mean, every celebrity from Beyonce to every celebrity, you know, posted a picture with him if they had it. You know, he's someone who's been loved and will always be loved and missed.
Yes, and of course it's so apropos that a biography about his life is coming out this Christmas, and had he lived another, you know, few years, he was 95. I mean, it still would be a great movie to see, but I think now people are really going to feel more compelled to see it, and maybe that's just going to be another part of his legacy. And that's another thing I think is kind of amazing. If you think about what prison does to a body, this man went to prison and he lived 95 years. Now, that doesn't have anything really to do with his servitude to mankind, but just a tough guy, if you will. I mean, just to live that long after being in prison.
Yeah, well, you know,
yeah,
again,
I mean,
his story, his middle name, it means father. They called him Father of the Nation, and you know, he was an extraordinary person. I mean, you know, it's almost as if, Dave, he was born to do what he did. He led a country out of apartheid. He's a symbol. He's a symbol of freedom. He's a symbol of peace. And so, I just, you know, in the way that Mother Teresa was real and touched people's lives and will always be an icon for us, I mean, that's kind of the same status that President Mandela will have. I mean, he's extraordinary. And so the fact that he did, you know, was locked up in jail for 27 years and became president, and the fact that he, you know, was a revolutionary and fought against apartheid and helped bring apartheid, you know, the end of apartheid to South Africa. I mean, we could go on and on and talk about all the amazing things that he did, and he will forever symbolize freedom.
Yes, and for those people that don't exactly understand how apartheid is different than segregation in America, it is like segregation in America that era, but it's adding to what happened to the Native Americans. I mean, it's like their country was taken over, and then they were segregated. So they kind of, you know, the South African Native citizens, they suffered the indignities of the American Indian with the experience of African Americans on top of it, sans the slavery. But, I mean, you put those two together, and you begin to get an idea of what it was. Well, let's welcome in our co-host week in and week out. Welcome, Catherine Smith.
Hello. I'm so sorry that I am late. I would tell you a funny story about why, but we're in the middle of a segment.
Yeah, well, maybe we'll get to the
later.
Yeah. Well, go ahead, Catherine. I guess you can kind of close down our discussion of Nelson Mandela's life. Just give any thoughts you have about his passing this week.
Well, I have to say that it was very emotional for me, and I kind of, you know, I was sort of preparing for it because he'd been ill for, you know, quite some time, and I think we were all sort of anticipating, but it was very emotional for me. As most of our listeners know, I'm older than a lot of people, and the anti-apartheid movement was a real part of my young activism, and it really sort of enlivened the spirit of liberty and activism in me, and it was also a real source of a great deal of conversation at the time. I was working at a university, and there was a lot of discussion about divesting, and a lot of very emotional protestation, and so it was a very big part of my early sort of activism. So there was that, but also I must say that it's very sad that he died, but man, what a life! I mean, you cannot die at 95 having lived the life of Nelson Mandela and not think, boy, I'm tired. You know, that was quite a life to have lived. And so I just feel very fortunate to have actually shared the earth with him for the brief time that I did. And I think anyone who's been alive during his life should feel that way. If only to have had the opportunity to hear him speak or laugh or watch him smile. If only for that, brief experience of that, I think is an amazing experience. So, I feel for his family and children and grandchildren.
And I tell you, you're talking about the time he lived, just anybody that lived in that time period between, say, 1900 and 2000. I know his was, 20 years opposite of that in some way, but somewhere around that period, I think those people may have seen the most change in both technology and the way society functions in the world than any 100-year period in human history. You think about it, you had people that, you had colonization essentially when Nelson Mandela was born, and by the time it was, you know, free democracy for his country, that's on the social side. Then on the technological side, you know, the car was in its infancy. Radio really didn't exist. Television, the internet, computer, all those different things. Flight of any other than, you know, maybe the Wright brothers still. None of that existed. And then by the end of the time, you know, people were going to the moon and returning on space shuttles and everything else. And so I think anybody of that generation, witnessed all that. And that's just an amazing 100-year period in which to live in. So that is just a part of his story, if you will. Well, obviously, the funeral will be this week. I'm sure a huge delegation from America will go, including the president. And in some ways, I think it would be great if the president, and he may do this, invite some of the Republican leaders with him and say, look, guys, let's just talk. You know, let's not have this contentious, you know, who can get, you know, the better of who in front of cameras. Let's just talk about America and where we want to go, because maybe we could learn something from, you know, Nelson Mandela and F.W. de Klerk and what they accomplished, because they were on the opposite sides politically as well, if you look at the ruling party and the ANC, and they were able to work together. You know, maybe we could, you know, learn something out of this. Do y'all think that's something that could possibly happen, Alpha?
No.
I was going to say no.
Is it wishful thinking?
Yes. We should always be wishful during the holiday season, Dave. you know, I think that President Obama has done an extraordinary job of keeping America's face clean, frankly cleaning up a lot of the mess that George Bush made within the international community. However, you know, his ability to be able to get Republicans to sit down and talk, that hasn't happened yet. And so while I wish they would, I just think it's unlikely.
Yeah. Catherine, any thoughts there?
Well, if their behavior around this is any indication, obviously they're not going to be willing to talk. I mean, there's been a lot of awfully unpleasant comments about President Mandela.
Yeah, I mean, just you're thinking maybe if you get, you know, John Boehner, probably particularly Ted Cruz, just invite him to the plane, because this may be something that, you know, Ted Cruz isn't going to necessarily get invited to otherwise, but since he's kind of the leader of the Tea Party wing of the Republican Party, you know, maybe in a, you know, without cameras, nobody to posture in front of, you could get a little something done. But maybe that's just wishful thinking, but I'm sure people in 1985 never thought, you know, 5 to 7 years, F.W. de Klerk would, you know, do what he did either. So, you know, you can always hope. Well, listen.
Yeah, we can always hope.
Yeah, we go. And it's the season for hope. So let's kind of move forward. We invited Op onto the show, Florida expert, and that's probably the largest southern state we have not covered in the past few weeks, and there are some great races. First thing, Oppa, I looked on Politics One at all the different races. It looks like pretty much everybody in Florida is running for something. You're not running for anything, are you?
Never.
Okay. Well, let's start out with a governor, and we can't begin to even talk about all these candidates, so we'll kind of talk about the biggies. You got Rick Scott, the current governor, who's not real popular, if you believe the polling. He does have some Republican opposition. Any chance that one of these Republican challengers is strong enough, or will he at least be his party standard bearer?
I think he'll definitely be the party standing bearer. Probably the most exciting thing about the Florida governor's race is that every year it's exciting. I mean, every time it's up for election. You know, Rick Scott has definitely proved that you can say really dumb things, be a horrible leader, and still get reelected. And so I'm always interested to see what happens in that race.
Yes. And then, of course, you've got the Democrats. There are multiple candidates, but there's two that I guess have kind of separated themselves from the pack. Nan Rich, who was the head of the state Senate. She's been in the state Senate, been in the state House, a known commodity, but not necessarily a big money raiser, if you will, but somebody that everybody considers a true Democrat. Then you have Charlie Crist, the former governor, the former attorney general, who served in both of those offices as a Republican. Now, he was a fairly moderate Republican, and moderate Republican might as well be Democrat in some people's eyes, but I don't know that Democrats feel that way. Up on the Democratic side, how do people feel about this thing?
Well, let me say this. I'd say the Democrats are definitely going to have a much easier time, since a lot of the a lot of money, frankly, is being spent super early into the, you know, into the cycle. Right now, for example, in South Florida and parts of Central Florida, they're running negative ads against Governor Crist. And so the reason why I'm bringing that up is that even though, you know, Rick Scott is likely to spend about $100 million or better to try to retain his seat, he's going to have a hard time just amongst his own field. I mean, coming out of that Republican primary is going to be a beast, and he's likely to – he's going to need every dollar of that $100 million because he's going to have it coming to him at every side. So what's exciting in terms of the Democratic side, I definitely think that Nan Rich is a party favorite. You know, I get my emails from the party, especially down there in South Florida and Central Florida, and Nan Rich is certainly a favorite of the party. There are a lot of folks that are kind of stepping up to the plate and helping her raise money. She's got some of the biggest bundlers in the state paying attention to her and her race, and so this really could be, you know, a good matchup for her. I think having a strong Democrat in place that can get in there and raise some money is going to be key and important, because there will be no mincing of you know, words and messaging from the Republican side. And so after they're done tearing them, you know, each other up, they'll be ready to tear the Democrat up. And so, you know, I definitely think that Nan Rich is the party favorite. That's kind of my my Florida take on things. But, again, one thing we do know about those Florida primaries, especially on the Democratic side, is between now and qualifying, you know, anybody could jump in. It could become anyone's race.
Yes. Well, I tell you what, I don't want to ask all the questions. Catherine, we hadn't even put this thing together and talked about the general at all, but if you have any other follow-up questions on the primaries or whatever you have on the Florida governor's race.
Well, so where does that leave Charlie Crist? Is he just sort of a – isn't he running for governor too?
Yeah, he actually is planning on announcing probably – no, actually last his expected announcement last week. He didn't announce yet, but everybody believes that he's going to be running. You know, they're so excited to get ads up against him. I mean, they've already kind of have that popular.
Yeah.
I think that's an effort to keep him out of the race. But I definitely think that Governor Crist is going to run, and you know he's no stranger to negative ads, or you know they're going to probably talk about how conservative he is and his stance on abortion. I mean, you know, it's that kind of year where you can definitely run left, and so you know I think he'll get
it.
Well,
do you think that it's possible? So he still has to get out of the primary. So you think that he'll lose in the primary because of he isn't left enough, and then
we'll
go into is that your thought?
I had speculation about whether I thought Governor Crist would make it through the primary. I would probably say no.
Okay.
Simply that's because just of the history. You know, Florida voters they're not like Mississippi or Tennessee voters. I mean, they're not as forgiving as. Some of the other southern states, they don't. Once you mess up and you make a mistake, they don't usually put you back in the seat again. So I think it's unlikely he'll make
it. Well, good for them.
I think it's unlikely he'll make it out of a primary, but I still think that he'll run.
Okay,
yeah.
So it's
well, I guess. Yeah, let's go ahead and put this thing together. Rick Scott's unpopular, but then if there's a more competitive primary battle on the Democratic side. Can the Democrat win this thing, particularly if the election turns like it has, say, in the past month? Because we know there was a Democratic trend going on, then it kind of ebbed back to a Republican trend, and we're still in that. And, of course, it may turn back five more times for Election Day, but let's just say it's more of a lower Democratic turnout election like some of these off-presidential years can be.
We all know that Florida is still not a blue state. We wouldn't even call it purple if we were really paying attention to what was going on. And so I mean, it's a Republican stronghold. If the Democratic Party doesn't have a statewide effort to get the Democrats out to the poll, in other words, if we don't have an exciting Democratic candidate who can get the people out, who's raising money and making sure voters get to the polls, I mean, there's no way that we'll have a Democratic victory. However, as your Florida representative, I definitely want to be positive and you know, excited about the fact that we have, again, another opportunity. You know, if we can get enough independent votes, we just might be able to swing it. But if the Democrats stay home and they don't communicate message that is clear and concise and spend a whole bunch of money and time talking to independent voters, it's not going to happen.
Yes. Well, I mean, that's important to have. And, of course, I look at this list of candidates, and there's several Republicans, there's several Democrats besides the two he mentioned. Maybe one of them serious, but then there's a ton of independents as well. But then you keep looking down at the laundry list of candidates, and it says lieutenant governor, the seat is vacant. Why are folks not running for lieutenant governor? What's going on there with the office being vacant and nobody, you know, swarming around it?
I wish I knew the answer to that, Dave. The only thing I can say is, you know, it's a joint candidacy seat, and so there's going to have to be someone. Let me pretend that that somebody's smart. And, for example, let's say Charlie Crist wins and then he invites Rick Scott to come in and be his lieutenant governor. That's typically how it works in Florida. So what they'll do is they will kind of see who the front runner is on each side, and then the front runner will essentially hand pick who their lieutenant governor is. It's the same way we kind of run our presidential elections, where you really pay attention to the top of the ticket, and then the top of the ticket guy or gal picks their running mate, essentially. And they together. Yeah.
Yeah. And that tells us all. You said, yeah, I mean, you told us exactly what needs to, you know, what's going on, because if it is a running mate state and it's the office that's been vacated, then they're just waiting to have the nominating convention to or before then to name the person, and they'll be set. Well, let's continue on. I know that y'all don't have a Senate race coming up this time, but there will be you have one of your senators, Marco Rubio, who, you know, he won the primary, beat Charlie Crist, won the general election over Kendrick Meek, was the star of the party. Then he just started to moderate from his Tea Party roots just a little bit, not really that much. And the Tea Party seemingly has turned against him because Ted Cruz is, you know, very much more so the flavor of the month. But my question to you, Appa, is Marco Rubio still popular in Florida, or is this the national, you know, Republican Tea Partiers that are against him?
Marco Rubio is still positive in Florida. You know, I haven't seen any recent polling, but nobody I know likes him. I think Marco Rubio, you know, he became kind of a doll of his party for a while, and he's definitely got name recognition nationally as well as in Florida. I don't know what his favorabilities are, but I would imagine that if his party turned their back on him, that he's not a favorite of the party at the moment, which may mean that Democrats like him more. I don't know. You know, exactly where his favorables are right now, but I can definitely guess that on a national scale, he's probably a little bit more liked than he is locally. And I think that's going to affect his career in Florida. And so he will likely end up in some appointed job somewhere making a whole bunch of money and writing a autobiography.
Yes.
You heard it here first.
Catherine, anytime jump in, you need to ask about any of these Florida things you need to follow up on Rubio. Do you have any thoughts on Rubio?
No, I think Appa's got it right on the money.
Yeah, well, let me ask you a question. Do you think Marco Rubio, I mean, you know, he was getting mentioned heavily as a VP nominee instead of Paul Ryan. He got passed over, and of course, I've seen a lot of books that, you know, talk about, you know, what can the GOP do to rebuild, and, of course, winning the Hispanic vote or at least becoming competitive in some races as part of that. Do you think Marco Rubio can still rebuild his national brand, or is it should he just stay focused on Florida to keep his Senate seat?
If I was working for Marco Rubio, I would tell him to start his autobiography and see if he can get on CNN or Fox.
So get a gig kind of like Joe Scarborough, who was a Florida congressman, right?
Yeah. The thing is that our politicians, when we retire them and we decide we don't like them anymore, we send them to TV.
Well, thanks a lot for that, Appa.
You know, although that didn't work out so well for, Catherine Harris. I mean, I believe she tried to get a TV gig, and people weren't as interested in her. So, you know, happens sometimes, not others. Well, there's a lot of congressional seats in Florida. We can't talk about all of them, but let's talk about District 13. Representative Bill Young, who served for many, many years in the Tampa area, I believe he set one of the longevity records at one point, since he had served since something like the 60s, if you will, in that Tampa Bay seat. He passed away, and, of course, They've had the filing deadline on November 19th. So the thing's set to be a primary on January 14th, a general election on March 11th. You have three Republicans, Alex Sink is the Democrat, a Libertarian, and a write-in candidate. Not exactly sure why he couldn't get on the regular ballot with a regular party, but for whatever reason, that's what it is. Tell us what you know about this race.
Well, I can tell you I'm really excited about this race. You know, it's an R plus one, which means that there's definitely a chance for a Democrat to win. And the fact that they've cleared the field for Alex Sink, I think, is great because she's going to be able to raise the money. She's a proven fundraiser. The party will get rallied behind her. And frankly, you know, she's got no shortage of ability and to be able to run TV and run radio and send out mail, where she can really put together a great campaign. You know, Alex Sink's only enemy, essentially, is often herself. But if she can smile a little bit more and, you know, get her handshake together, I think she'll be in good shape. The Republicans, you know, Larry Crow, Kathleen Peters, Nick Zoller, you know, a lot of unknowns. I mean, they don't have a lot of name recognition in the state, frankly, or in the district. And so I really see a great opportunity here for a Democratic victory, which is why this seat is so exciting.
Yes. Well, Catherine, any questions on this race or some other congressional races?
Yeah, does the fact that there's a Libertarian and a write-in candidate help Alex Sink, or does it help the Republicans?
I think that, you know, at the end of the day, the votes that a Democrat could lose to a Libertarian or Independents really comes down to your ground game. I mean, what are we doing? In an R plus one, as a Democratic campaign, you've got to know by now that you've got to go door to door and you've got to lock in your Democratic base. You've also got to make sure you do communications and direct voter contact to the Independents, because it's going to take a certain amount of independence to win. You're in a R plus one. You're in a Republican-leaning district. And so I'd like to say that we can understand it as a party strategically and do the things we need to do to lock in those independent votes. You know, it's not a super conservative district, even though it is, does lean a little bit Republican. You know, it's one of those races where a Democrat can definitely take it. And how the Libertarian votes or independent votes fall is going to be dependent on who's out there doing the communication with the voters.
Well, at least you have the whole cycle to work on that instead of just post-primary, so that's a big advantage.
Definitely.
Yes. Well, we know you're in and out of different parts of the state working in races. Any other congressional districts that you really see as something that we ought to get on the radar sooner than later?
I tell you about this little race that I am super excited about. It's in Pennsylvania 12, where Aaron McClelland is running against, the Republican incumbent is Keith Rothfuss. And it's an R plus 6, so it's a Republican-leaning district. But I like to call Aaron McClelland a little engine that could. I mean, she is a fresh face and a gorgeous one. You might want to stop by her website, which is Aaron14.com. She's just a gorgeous candidate, inside and out. I mean, I've had some time to talk to her and work with her a little bit, and she is just as focused as they can get. She's got a good, clear, concise message. She actually comes from a community-based organization background. She's also a registered therapist, a licensed therapist, and you know, just someone who's got such a strong grasp of policy and, you know, really cares about the legislation and making a difference, which is so rare. And I call it a little engine that could, because despite all the fist fighting that she's had to do to raise money, she's been consistent. And I think we see a little jump in her numbers from the last two quarters. And I think that this, you know, quarter four and quarter one are really going to be the tell-all quarters. That's a pretty interesting race. And, you know, I always like to keep my eye on Florida, those three, you know, districts in South Florida where you have, they called them the Cuban seats 2 years back. They used to be 17, and I mean, they used to be 18, 21, and 25. Now they're 25, 26, and 27. So you've got, in 27, which used to be 18, you've got Ileana Ross Leighton. She's been in that seat since 1989, and no one is running against her. And she's sitting pretty right now. She's an incumbent. No one has filed against her on the Democratic side or the Republican side. And so if there's anyone out there listening who lives anywhere near Florida 27, please get in that race. I hate to see Ileana Ross Leighton continue to coast through her tenure. And the fact that that's an R plus two, you know, back in 2008, it was an R plus eight. And now it's just an R plus two because they've moved so many Democratic voters into that district. So, you know, that's exciting. Florida 26 is now a Democratic, you know, D plus one is a Democratic district. And Joe Garcia is, you know, they've cleared the field for him. There's currently no Democrat running against him. But Congressman Garcia will have about six Republican opponents in that race. One whose last name is Starbuck, which could be confused with Starbucks. That was a joke. In Florida 25.
Oh, I thought you were just saying this guy had a real chance to pick up some votes or something. I thought you were seeing it as a plus.
I was just making a joke because, you know, Floridians love their coffee. In one more I just want to point out here. I love talking to you about with these, you know, these South Florida seats here. I am a Miami girl. Florida 25, you know, again, the same thing. It's an R plus 5 Republican stronghold. Mario Diaz-Balart currently holds that seat. He's been there since 2002, and there's no one running against him on the Republican side or the Democratic side. On the one more thing I want to talk about, right down there in Miami where we have, since 2010, Frederica Wilson, that Florida 24 used to be Florida 17, and that is a D plus 34. So there is no stronger Democratic hold in the country. Well, there's a couple, but it's one of the top in the country. It is certainly the most Democratic district in the state of Florida. And so, you know, we're going to see Congresswoman Wilson probably make it out of that primary. There's a Haitian American, Michael Etienne, who is going to be facing her in the Democratic primary. You know, again, unlikely that he can have any kind of victory against her. I mean, Frederica Wilson is just going to be strong. But you know, frankly, I could go on and on about most of these races. I'm pretty excited about what's going on in Florida. And I'm especially excited about those races we just discussed because there is such an opportunity there for us to maintain or gain as Democrats.
Yes, just one more I want to mention. Just the other week, Trey Radel, a congressman from Florida, was arrested for cocaine possession. First member of Congress just in years to have that happen. Is his seat in jeopardy? I think I've heard it's a pretty Republican seat, but no matter what your political inclination is, your leader, you know, being arrested for buying drugs is not a good scene. What does his thing look like?
Well, it's an R plus 12, and you know he's been in that seat since 2012. So he literally just got in. He's managed to get himself in a world of trouble in just 2 years. But currently, there is no Republican running against him. You know, there's a Democrat there, April Freeman. He's a Libertarian candidate. Libertarians do not win in Florida, FYI. If they win anywhere else in the country, I haven't heard about it. But it's a Republican stronghold. So the fact that there's no Republican hopping in that race, it makes me wonder if the Republican Party think it's okay to be caught with cocaine. You know, it may be their new fad. Who knows?
Yeah, I know the rumor is that Connie Mack IV, who ran for Senate to vacate that seat, might just kind of take his seat back, and then he would run as the de facto incumbent. But, of course, he hadn't made his move yet. It seems like he'd be the way to strike where the iron is hot, if you will. So that'll be one to watch because that could be one of those kind of seats where you said a Republican plus 12, seat. We really shouldn't be winning that seat, but if they don't take care of business, much like we almost picked off that seat in South Carolina when Mark Sanford ran again, he really shouldn't have been the nominee, but the seat was so Republican, but it was close. This thing could get closer than it should be. Well, let's come north a little. Oh, go ahead, Appa.
I was just going to say, I mean, that's a little bit of a pattern in Florida. I mean, you know, we do things a little more sexy and slow than anywhere else in the country. And so, you know, they may get in at the last minute, but I just don't think that the Republican Party is going to just let Trey Riddle, you know, coast through this thing. The incumbent is currently the only Republican in the race, but if his party leaves him standing there, I think that's a huge mistake for them. And frankly, everybody around that district ought to talk about it. And they should make a national story of it, about the fact that they're not doing anything about it, because, you know, there are certain things I think that I would hope that the, you know, whether you're a Democrat or a Republican, you know, being a leader and getting caught with cocaine is kind of a big deal, even in Florida.
And not going to jail.
Yeah,
because I guess some people are seeing also another problem would be that he used his power and influence to avoid what an average person would have happened to them. Well, let's move north of the border up to Georgia. And our politicians made a little news in a sad way, if you will. Ralph Hudgens, the insurance commissioner of Georgia, he made news several months back. He was speaking to a group of folks in my county, probably 2 miles from where I live, at an airport airplane hangar at some Republican event. And he said he was going to sabotage Obamacare. He got a big round of applause. Now, that was kind of an egregious thing, that if you're in charge of insurance, that you're going to actually sabotage people trying to get health insurance. But he kind of took it to a whole other level. He was caught on video again, and this time he compared somebody having a pre-existing medical condition to being a reckless driver. Now, obviously, we know that some people should try to improve their driving, but a lot of times you're born with illnesses. Illnesses take over on you due to no fault of your own. But for some reason, our insurance commissioner does not understand this, Catherine. First, just what was your reaction to this comment?
You know, my reaction was, how the heck did this guy get elected? And, you know, I hadn't really looked at his history, and so I went back and looked at what his background is, and it's in agriculture and real estate. So I don't know why the Republicans felt like he was a good candidate for insurance commissioner, but he also has a lot of friends in the insurance business. A lot of big contributors to his campaign are from our insurance companies that were opposed to the Affordable Care Act. So there's that bit of it. But I was just embarrassed at the stupidity of it. And then I don't know if you're going to go further and talk about how he tried to backpedal on it by saying, well, what he said was that it would be like if you got in a car accident and didn't have insurance and then called to get insurance after you got in the car accident. And then he said that this was taken out of context. It was a videotape with his words. I mean, there was no way of taking it out of context. But later he tried to backpedal by saying, well, okay, he used a different analogy, saying that, say you arrive home and your house is a fire, and so you call your insurance agent to make sure you have enough coverage if the fire should, you know, take your whole house. So, yeah, none of those are the same as pre-existing conditions. Sorry, Ralphie.
No, it's totally different. It shows that his lack of understanding or callousness. It's hard to determine which one. Appa, we know you're not in the state of Georgia, but this is how this guy feels, and unfortunately I have the feeling there's more Republicans throughout the South and country that may feel this way. What was your reaction?
I love insurance commission races because insurance commissioners tend to be, how can I put this, businessmen and or previous politicians who now want a cushy job. And so, you know, the fact that he was so callous in his remarks, I think that's exactly the way we should frame it, you know, goes to tell us that, you know, Mr. Hudgens doesn't care. And, you know, frankly, whether you believe these things or not, the fact that they can come out of your mouth is scary. Healthcare is a huge issue, not just in Georgia, but across the nation. And really, we need insurance commissioners who are standing up and saying we have to do more to make sure we keep people healthier. You know, if we have people with pre-existing conditions, we need to get them good health care to keep them alive as long as we can and keep them comfortable. You know, to do any kind of preventative care to make sure that if you have a pre-existing condition, that doesn't somehow segue into other sicknesses or illness. You know, health care is a huge issue nationally, and I think that this here is a clear illustration. Commissioner Hudgens' comments is a clear illustration and a continuation, frankly, of how the Republican Party feels about making sure Americans have access to quality health care. They don't care.
Yes.
Well, and they think it's our fault. They think it's the patient's fault. It's their fault for being, you know, for getting cancer.
As much, if I could see the commissioner, I would tell him having a pre-existing condition and needing health care coverage is you want to compare it to something. Compare it to being born in poverty and, you know, ending up in a failing school. You know, there's really nothing that you could do about it. It's where you're from. It's where you grow up. You can do what you can to get out of that situation, but you're born in. So if he needs some analogies, you guys have him call me. You guys know my number.
Yes,
well, but, you know, they don't have a lot of patience for poverty either. So.
Yeah, I know. I think your analogy's good. I just don't think that would get him to move either because he's just kind of like, well, if it gets in the way of somebody making money, it's just not really a problem. And that's, you know, a lot of Republicans, not all, but a lot of Republicans, that's kind of what they function on is, does it hurt business? Is it going to get in the way of somebody making money? It's about the freedom to make money, and that's it. And if it's, you know, hurts the bottom line, then it's not worth talking about. And so that's where this
and
comes
that
from. And I
is
think
why,
also,
David, ahead, that's why I don't understand why they're against the Affordable Care Act. Because the insurance companies are fixing to make a lot of money on this.
Yeah.
And honestly, I think there's a lot of business people that I've been told will say, look, you know, I'm sick of my business being responsible for the health care of everybody. It's kind of an inhibitor. And they say that, you know, Japan, their businesses that are successful, they really kind of like it that somebody else takes care of health care. It doesn't tie, you know, it's not tied to your work. Of course, people with pre-existing or conditions that come up then feel like they have to be locked in a job. Their spouse has to be locked in a job and can't leave because they don't want to, you know, mess up that insurance because they know they'll have a pre-existing condition with the next insurance carrier. So they're like they have to stay there. And then, of course, that hurts business. So there's a lot of ways to look at this thing. Well, let's look at the political side of this thing. Catherine, is anybody going to run against this guy? I mean, nobody stepped forward to yet. I mean, this guy's making like a third dumb comment.
Well, you know, there's a lot of people talking to Dr. Rad about running for insurance commissioner. That's something I've been seeing, like, on Facebook, Dr. Rad, please run for insurance commissioner. People I've spoken to have said, yeah, everybody's trying to talk him into it, but he's not really interested. So that's the only thing I know.
Yeah, and for those of you that don't know, that's the, I guess you'd almost say number two candidate for the Democratic nomination for Senate. Michelle Nunn is kind of the first candidate. But then Dr. Rad, I don't think we'll expect too much out of him. But then people got to hear him. He was on our show. Have got to see a lot about him. They're like, wow, this guy's way better than I expected. And so he's kind of exceeded expectations, and now he's been recruited into other races, right, Catherine?
That's the way it looks, but I don't think he's interested. That's my impression.
Yeah. So, Appa, what's your experience where candidates are in one race and then look and see a different race as a better fit? Have you seen people have good luck with that?
You know, frankly, it really depends. There are some pros and cons to that. I mean, switching races, you know, or switching seats or office that you're seeking in the middle of an election can definitely be a bad thing, because your donors, for example, may see that as you not really having a dedication to that office or that race that you were initially in. You just want a seat, and you'll take any seat you can get, kind of thing. That can definitely help, you know, hurt you with your base. On the positive side of that, if you have something where there's kind of, you know, you're moving seats or you're changing the office you want to run for. If that's happening in reaction to something as drastic as an insurance commissioner who thinks that a pre-existing condition is like a car accident, that can play really well for you. Again, it's all about your messaging. For example, if I was going to run, which I would never run, Dave, but if I was creating
the message. She said that twice so far tonight.
if I was creating the messaging for a candidate, for example, who was leaving a seat and then going to move to the insurance commission race, they would say something like, you know, my commitment, the reason why I decided to run for X office is because I wanted to make a difference and help others. And so when I heard our insurance commissioner make these kinds of callous statements, I knew that I had to step in there. No one was going to run for that seat. And as much as I wanted to be there and be a leader for the people of, you know, X district, I knew that I could make a real difference as insurance commissioner and that somebody had to step in and help the people of the state of Georgia. I mean, you know, it's really all about how that race is framed and how you frame your move. So, you know, the question is what's happened in the race that you're jumping to, and when you move, how are you going to explain that to your base of support?
Yes, and I think that was some good advice. Now, he does have Eric Gray working for him.
Not anymore.
Communication. Not anymore. Oh, well, that may hurt things, because kind of guy that was probably smart enough to say, look, there's a real opportunity, and then if you get in this race and this office and do a good job, then, you know, a federal office, if that's really your end goal, may come open. Well, let's kind of go the opposite direction, you know, telling people the right things to say. The Rolling Stone magazine made a list of the 50 dumbest comments of GOP leaders this year. And you think, man, a list of 50, there's probably, you know, 20 good ones. Well, not the case. Even the 40s have some doozies. I'm going to defer to y'all ladies first. Catherine, since you've played these little kudzu vine games before, give us which one really stuck out to you as one of the dumbest things said.
Well, I only got to number 30 from number – I started at 50, and I got to 30, and I already had 5 that were my favorite. So I think since I'm in Georgia, I'm going to have to go with a Georgia GOP fellow. Number 33. The quote is, gee whiz, the hormone level created by nature sets in place the possibility for these types of things to occur. That's from our Georgia Senator, Saxby Chambliss, regarding the military rape epidemic. Essentially, he's saying boys will be boys, and they will rape. I remember when this came out, I was so outraged by it. I could not even believe that these words could come out of a senator's mouth. But, you know, that's our Saxby.
Well, and I guess that's why the Republicans had that How to Talk to Women conference this past week that was so widely reported. I guess that type of thing was trying to be curbed or reframed. Appa, what did you glean from this list?
Well, right in that same vein there, I think Catherine and I are on the same page. I love number 40, Mary Sue McClurkin from Alabama. And she said, when a physician removes a child from a woman, that is the largest organ in the body. And of course, doing what a lot of Republicans are doing, and that's putting their foot in their mouth about what a woman should do with her body. You know, Mary Sue McClurkin is kind of famous for saying things that don't make sense, but when you have one woman make such a ridiculous remark about something that she ought to know about, frankly, it's always appalling. And so I tip my hat to her, you know, and the Alabama House of Representatives certainly has a special one in Representative McClurkin.
Yes, you get the idea that the Republican Party leaders of the country, if they wanted to recruit some new candidates for the future, they could go to science teachers and say, hey, who flunked your class? We need them. you know, because they actually think that a baby is part of your is one of your organs. I'm hoping at least in the reproductive system, but, hey, maybe she thought it was part of the digestive system. Who knows? All bets are off when talking about Republicans and science.
What happened that they were actually discussing a bill that would, you know, create these extra, you know, a host of extra regulations that would happen in Alabama's 5 abortion clinics. And
right.
The legislation would require physicians at abortion clinics to have certain kinds of privileges at other hospitals. You know, it essentially creates a whole bunch of rules and regulations for what kind of doctors can perform abortions. And so, you know, in her explanation of why this legislation made sense, she just talked about how, you know, that's a big surgery. You don't have any other organs in your body that are bigger than that. Well, unfortunately, a baby isn't an organ, Representative McClurkin, but I understand your point, I guess, question mark?
Well, I tell you, I'm kind of shocked that y'all left me with number one. And I'm just going to read the quote. You're going to be like, eh, big deal. Yeah, I would. And that's what Nevada Assemblyman Jim Wheeler said. You're thinking, well, that's the same thing. But he was asked the question, if your constituents wanted to reinstate slavery, he said, yeah, I would. If they want it, I'll do it. So no profiles and courage award for this guy. This guy says he just wants to serve in office. He doesn't want to make a difference. He just wants to get reelected. I mean, just the audacity to say that, like, I would vote for anything, even the biggest sin against man that in our nation's history. Yeah, I'd reinstate it. I'd take us back 150 years. You know, if the people wanted it, if it polled good. I just couldn't believe that when this happened a few months ago. But since it was Nevada, we didn't feel like we should cover it. But this gave me an excuse to talk about Jim Wheeler, the guy I guess you could literally say would vote for anything. Guys, we've got like just 2 or 3 minutes and kind of need to follow up on a story from last week. We spent time at length talking about if Thad Cochran would run for reelection. Our guest, Robert Hooks, he kind of seemed kind of 50-50 on the proposition. He wouldn't have been surprised if Thad Cochran did not run. But, indeed, he has decided to seek reelection. Appa, you have run numerous races in Mississippi, including statewide races. How popular, how big an icon is Thad Cochran in Mississippi?
Well, he's as big as they get. I mean, you just don't do anything in Mississippi without going to see the good senator. You know, he's a good old boy, and the people of Mississippi love him. He's the second largest serving Republican, and he'll seek another term because that's where he'll die, frankly. He loves his seat, and he loves the beauty that comes with being a senator. You know, I hate to say it, but he's kind of a nice guy when you meet him. I mean, I had the opportunity back in 2007 to spend a little time with the senator, and what I remember about him was just how warm he made me feel. I mean, he kind of looked at me with his blue eyes, and he really made me, I had to remind myself what kind of voting record this guy had. You know, the fact that he's got such high ranking, he sits on the Appropriations Committee, he's got 1,000 reasons why Mississippians ought to keep him. He's a senior member of the Appropriations Committee, in fact. And, you know, the fact that he's turning 76 and wants to run again is no surprise. He's looking forward to it. People have been generous, and they've expressed affection for him. People in Mississippi love him. And even though he's been there since 1978, which is 2 years before I was born, you know, he's number two in seniority amongst Republicans behind Utah. So he's got a lot of weight in the United States Senate. He's got a lot of weight in the state of Mississippi, and people in Mississippi love him.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see if the Tea Partiers can get him, if you will. And they love Tea Partying people in the Republican primary. So this may be the race to watch it and maybe South Carolina. Catherine, last comment on this. Were you surprised or did it sound like it'd go either way?
You know, I wasn't surprised, but it's a little bit disappointing. You know, he's going to be, if he is elected, he'll be 83 when he finishes his that term. And I just think, you know, at some point, it's in everyone's best interest, both his party and the country, to, you know, open up some seats for some younger people, some, you know, groom people so that they can run. I mean, I'm sure he's, like Appa said, I'm sure he's a fine man, and he does have very high rankings on some important committees. But, you know, let some young people run for a change. I mean, this is a problem in our country. You know, our senators are all old. Not all of them, but a lot of them. And most of them are old white guys. So
there are the exceptions, the Ted Cruz's and the Cory Booker's.
Yeah, there are exceptions,
party.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay.
But it is a problem.
Yeah. Well, it's been a great show, Appa. Once again, you've been a great guest. Thanks for coming in and informing us on Florida politics. And we know you're working all over the country, and you sent us candidates in the past, and I have a feeling you'll send us a candidate or two to be on our show in the future.
Oh, yeah.
I'm sorry I was late, but I will tell you, I was having a nightmare about the show, so I'm glad that the nightmare didn't come true.
Well, it was tonight, so it was that quick. Appa, again, you send things along, and we're going to have you on again in the new year to talk about some more Florida.
I can't wait. Thank you guys so much.
It's always
a pleasure to talk with you and Catherine, Dave, and I can't tell you how much I appreciate you guys having me on. Thank you so much.
Happy holidays,
Appa.
You're
welcome.
Happy holidays.
Evening, everybody.
Good night.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Will a strong and united America still be a force for freedom and prosperity around the world?
America has created the longest peacetime economic expansion in our history.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Good.